interviewing Miss Jane Doolittle in Cortland, New York, September 29, 1983, Tape 1, Side 1. Miss Doolittle, thank you very much for this opportunity that you gave me to interview you for the Foundation for Iranian Studies. I would like to begin by asking you to give us your biographical data from the date you were born, the works that you did, the schools that you went to, and the services that you have rendered, especially to the people of Iran.
I was born in Reading, Pennsylvania on April 14, 1899. We lived in Reading until I was 6 years old when we moved to Yonkers, New York, where I grew up, although I had started school in Reading. I attended the public schools in Yonkers because at that time they were excellent schools. And when I finished the eighth grade, which was what was known as the primary school, I was sent to a boarding school in Riverdale, New York for 1 year, and then I went to Tabern School in Northampton, Massachusetts for my high school work. I was not planning on college at that time because my father felt that women didn't need college. But then I was convinced, when I was about 17 years old, I was convinced that I was called to work abroad. And so my father said, well, in that case, you must go to college. So I got busy and prepared myself for college between January and June of 1917. There was a lot to be done because I had just been taking finishing courses. I had to do several years of Latin and ancient history and English, mathematics, which I hadn't concentrated on. And I prepared myself for college and took the exams and entered Wells College in Aurora, New York, in September 1917. I went to Wells College because that was my mother's college and also my aunt's college, and it was a very good college. While I was there, I felt that I should prepare for medical work because I thought the thing that the countries abroad needed most was perhaps medical attention. So I took pre-medics work at college and was accepted in Cornell and Columbia for their medical schools. But at that time, a friend of mine had a fiance who went to Iran, which was then Persia. And he wrote to her saying that the girls' school in Tehran was in great need of teachers, and couldn't Wells College send a girl to the girls' school in Tehran? As there was Yale in China, Harvard, something south, and so on. So I was the president of the YWCA at the college, and we put on a campaign and raised the money, but there wasn't anybody to go at that time. After all, back in 1920, nobody ever heard of Iran, or rather Persia as it was then, and it was near Russia where there was so much going on. Nobody knew what the conditions were in Iran, so I was the goat. I gave up my medical training, and that in the summer of 1921, I started out for Iran. Transportation to Iran in those days was difficult. Formerly, they had used the Russian entry, but in 1921, Russia was too unstable and people couldn't travel through there. So we had to go down to India. I took a little ship, which was not very safe, and it went from New York to Bombay. It took us 32 days to get to Bombay. And then Gandhi was showing himself about in India at that time, so there were disturbances and there was no transportation to go from Bombay up to Basra. So we had to wait for a couple of weeks or even longer. There were several other people planning to go to Iran on the same boat. There were four or five of us who started off and saw India while we were waiting for a boat. And when I got back after 10 days traveling around to Agra and Allahabad and Benares and so forth, there was a boat ready for us, which had carried only six passengers to go up the Persian Gulf. So a young couple, the Markers, and I took that boat and went up to Basra. It took us a week to get there from Bombay. And then we took a little train which went up to Baghdad. It was an overnight ride. Then we were in Baghdad a few days. Then I got the train to Railhead. At Railhead we found there was no transportation to go on from there. And of course there were no conveniences. It was just out in the desert. There was nothing but the station. So the station master emptied his rooms for some Britishers who were in the party, and the Markers and I stayed in the storeroom with the cans for kerosene. And of course it's pure desert there. The Britishers who were with us, they had their own food and servants and all the rest, and of course we didn't, but we managed somehow. And that night we all spread our beds out in front of the station. In those days everybody carried their own beds and chairs and mosquito nets and what have you. And we stretched those at Britishers one end and we all went the same. And we were wakened in the morning by something that sounded like a car. And it was a car. And of course the Britishers thought it was for them, but it wasn't. It was for us. Because Mrs. Stead, who was in charge of the hospital in Kermanshah at that time, had been in Baghdad while we were there, and she had sent transportation back for us. So we got in this car and packed our luggage on the sides, strapped it on as they did in those days, trunks and so forth, and we started off for Kermanshah. At that time, at every station, at every village that you came to, there was a big pole put out in front of you, and you had to stop and give your pedigree and your passports and your past history and everything else before they let you go on. So we did that numerous times during the day, and when it was getting to be dusk, this was in October, so it got dark early, the village that we stopped in said, well, you'll have to spend the night here, because nobody travels at night, there are too many bandits. And we were young and ignorant, and we said, no, we would go on. So we did. And as it got darker, the driver fastened a lantern on the front of the car. He didn't have any lights. And then every little while he'd get out to look and see if we were really on the road or not. When I've traveled over that pass since then, I realized how the Lord preserved us taking that trip at night. And we reached Kermanshah about 10 o'clock. Nobody was looking for us because nobody traveled at night in those days. And we stayed there in Kermanshah with the missionaries for two or three days, time to give us to look around. And then we went on to Hamadan. That was another day's trip. And then I left the Markers there, and I went on from there with some Russians to Qazvin. And when we got to Qazvin, it became evident that they had some business there, so they left me at the Grand Hotel all by myself, with no language. when they went about their business. And 2 days later, they appeared and we started on again for Tehran. And that was an all-day's trip at that time. As we entered Tehran, it was very dark. There were no street lights. And we finally came to the mission compound, and the church was blazing with lights. They were having a meeting of some sort. And the missionaries from the school came running out to meet me at the door of the girls' school, which is where I lived for the next 3 years. Do you have any questions now?
No, I was wondering, were you feeling safe traveling under those conditions?
Yes, I had no fear.
It's strange.
Yeah.
An American girl, about 22 years old,
yeah,
going through all this experience of traveling in the desert.
Yeah. No, I had no fear. I was too young, too ignorant.
Would you be willing to go through that experience again?
Yes, I think so.
Very well. Now you're in Tehran. Had you officially joined the mission to come to work to Iran, or this was a completely different project?
No, it was under the mission. But I was what was known as a short-term teacher. The regular missionaries, of course, had to spend 3 to 5 years studying the language. But since I was a short-term teacher, meaning 3 years, I wasn't given a chance to learn the language. I just had to get busy teaching. And I lived in the eastern section of the school building, which was called Ingleside.
Where was the school, by the way?
It was just east of the church of Am Sultanay.
Yes.
And there were four of us living there, Miss McHenry and Miss Young and Miss Pete and myself. We lived together there for 3 years. And later on, Miss Chase joined us at that house. So I was ushered into the living room, which was a very small room, very poorly furnished with borrowed articles and worn out things. Nobody had anything new there then. And I settled down for my 3 years there. The next morning, Miss Pete took me around. She was at that time the principal. She took me around to show me the school and the girls and so forth. And by Monday morning, I was ready to start teaching. I think that was Friday I got there, maybe. Started teaching on Monday morning. And I taught a little bit of everything, as we always had to do. Anything that needed to be taught, we taught. Of course, everything I taught was in English at that time. And I picked up quite a bit of Persian from hearing it, but not having time to study it. But that was a big advantage later on when I wanted to study it. I liked the girls very much. Of course, they all wore their chadors at that time and their charvats and long skirts. I was interested in having them have some good athletic activities. And when I was at Wells College, I'd been a member of the hockey team. I liked hockey very much. So we had some very crude hockey sticks made by the carpenter in Tehran. And the girls were, and we got a piece of property which was to the east of ours, which the boys' school had been using, but was supposedly to belong to the girls' school. And thanks to money from Wells College, we were able to put up a wall at the southern end of that property and made it part of the girls' school, which it had not been. And that made a wonderful hockey field. And the girls would get out there with their sticks and their balls and their chalk hats and their long skirts and play hockey, racing from one end to the other. That was lots of fun. And then the girls also liked picnics. We would take them on Fridays two gardens outside of Tehran, which are now inside of Tehran. We get donkeys to take our load and start out 5 or 6 o'clock in the morning and get back 6 o'clock or so at night. That was a good recreation for everybody. And the girls weren't used to such things, they liked them. Then when the summer was coming along, the people who were living with me, Miss McHenry and Miss Young and Miss Pete, were all still studying the language because they'd gotten there just a couple months before I did. So they were going to be busy for the summer, and what was I going to do? So we decided we'd have a girls' camp. We called it Progress Camp. And were able to take 25 girls up country for a month's camping. We walked up because, of course, at that time there were no buses or anything. The only way to get there was to walk. So the girls arrived about 5 o'clock in the morning, and we walked and sang and walked and sang until we got there about 9:30 that morning. Our baggage had been sent ahead, the chinaware and so forth on the tabacasses and the other things on donkeys, and we got there on foot. And we had a very nice time there for a month. I think it was the only such camp that had ever been held before. They called it Progress Camp. And most of the girls, of course, were Armenian, because at that time, most of our students were Armenian. There were not too many Muslim girls or Jewish girls who came to school. But we had three or four Muslim girls in the group.
And what was the name of the school?
The school, the Iranians always knew it as an American girls' school, but its official name was Iran Bethel School.
And who had established Iran Bethel School?
It had been established by the Presbyterian Board of Foreign Missions back in 1872. At that time it was a boarding school with only Armenian girls. But gradually some Persian girls started coming. Back in 1890, the Shah, I think it was Nasiruddin Shah, heard that there were Muslim girls in our school, so he came to visit the school. With great excitement having the Shah come to visit Iran Bethel, and he saw everything. He went all around. Of course, they gathered all the girls in the assembly room for him to see. And he asked them various questions, and he saw the organ there, and he asked if somebody should play on it. So according to history, a little girl who was just learning to play sat down and played the organ for him. And that little girl was Gertrude Norla's mother. And then he asked somebody to write something on the blackboard. And of course the girls were too upset and excited to do anything, so he took the chalk from the girl and he himself wrote on the blackboard that Hakimul Mamalek Tashrif Arda. And that little piece, not so big, on the blackboard was preserved all through the years. I mean, it was framed on the blackboard so it wouldn't be disturbed with his writing on it. And after we left that building, I got that cut out and I think framed with its frame, its glass, and gave it to Demavan College. And I don't know what's happened to it now, but that piece was still there. So those were exciting times. The first graduates were graduated in 1991, I think, and that was just two girls. Two Armenian girls. And the next year there were no graduates. In 93 there were again two girls, again Armenian. And the first year that there were any non-Armenians graduated was 1915. It took all those years before there were any Muslim or Jewish girls to be graduating. They were all Armenians.
Did the Armenian girls have to come to school wearing chador and charvet too?
I think they did to begin with. When I got there, they didn't. Their mothers still wore chador and charvet and so forth, but the girls did not. The Armenian girls did not.
But the Muslim girls did have to do that?
Oh yes, oh yes. They all came very carefully veiled. And on wet days, all their chadors were spread all over the place to get them dry because, of course, they didn't have umbrellas. They used their chadors to protect them. And we had racks all along the walls of the hall so the girls could hang up these chadors dry.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Can you tell me something about the social environment of and life of the people at that time? It's very interesting.
Yes. Well, what aspects particularly?
I mean, how people did go about their social life and socializing? What did they do? I mean, what were you doing there? I mean, where, for instance, you as an American, were you accepted into the society?
Yes, very much so. In those days, the movies and the American army and so forth had not come to Iran, and so they set the Americans on a pedestal rather, and they were always eager to have us visit them. Every afternoon after school we would go to their homes. And of course the women in those days had no recreation whatsoever. There was nothing for them. They just sat at home and took care of their children and their husbands. So they were always glad to have anybody from outside. And one of our chores during the holidays, in those days we gave Jewish holidays and Armenian holidays and Muslim holidays, and whenever holidays came up, the students would expect us to call them. And so we would set out about 9 o'clock in the morning and drink tea all morning, and call on as many people as we could, and come back for lunch. We start out 2 o'clock in the afternoon, get back at 6, calling in their homes. They were very eager to have us. And as I said, they had very little to do of interest. In 1919 or 20, Mrs. Boyce, who was the head of the Alumni Association of the Girls' School, had the girls start a magazine, Alem and Esmond, to give them something to do. That is, had the graduates do that, the Alumni Association. And for about 13 years, they published this magazine and sent it all through Iran. They had a subscription, I think about, I'm afraid to say, was it 400 or 4,000, but anyway, it was very few. But everybody liked that very much. And they had a great time getting articles for it. And one of the articles that was appreciated most was under the name of Hanum, Dilshad Hanum. Did you ever hear of Dilshad Hanum?
No.
Dilshad Hanum was Oraya Nahostin, that's Nozad, the uncle of Ahmad Hanum. Did you know him?
No.
Well, he was a very interesting person and a very keen Christian, and he used to write articles and sign it Dilshad Hanum, and everybody thought it was a lady that was writing these articles, and they were very well accepted at that time. That gave these women something to do. As I say, it kept up for about 13 years, and it was, I don't know whether the first or the second women's magazine to be published in Iran. And it was very well liked, but gradually they found it was too much hard work to get it out and supervise it and provide finances for it and so forth, so they gave it up. But they really had no social life. Now, for instance, in order to raise money to help this, they had to find various means. And one idea was to have a movie performance, because the women couldn't go to movies, although by 1927 or 8, movies were in Tehran. But the women couldn't go to them, only the men went to them. So somebody had the bright idea of having a movie given at our school and charged for it and so forth. But there was great excitement as to what they should do, because it would have to be a man who would run the movie, and he would hear women's voices, and that was not allowable. But they finally had it, and they earned quite a bit for the magazine. But their lives are very narrow, very uninteresting. But they had a good time in their own homes. It was always amazing to me what good times they did make up, and how the children of the second or third wife would associate with the other children, and the wives all got along so well together. That was amazing.
How much did you know about Iran before you went to Iran?
Very little. There was very little literature on the subject, because it was out of the way. Nobody was particularly interested in Iran.
Were you surprised or disappointed or what when you got to Iran?
Well, I think one of the things that impressed me most was the condition of the beggars on the street at that time. You'd see a bundle of rags on the side of the road, and you'd discover it was a woman, and the rags were her chadar. She'd be sitting there and begging. And of course, we didn't know at that time that she probably, under her chadar, had a nice little brazier keeping her warm. But she was so surrounded by her chadar that it wasn't evident. Of course, the things that were difficult there in living were the lack of central heating, the lack of telephones, the lack of taxis, cars, lack of, telephones, the lack of electricity, the lack of plumbing. We didn't have any of those things in those days. And the electricity didn't come on until 1937. And the running water didn't come on until 1954. It really was amazing the conditions that we lived in at that time. But we sort of expected them, and therefore were not bothered by them.
Was the church's role in the school?
Well, the church, as a church, of course, didn't have any role there, but the missionaries, the women missionaries finally revolted at having a man as the head of their school committee. They thought they could manage the school themselves, which they did. But the church itself never had anything to do with it as such. And of course, in those days, the church was in the hands of the missionaries. It wasn't in the hands of the Iranians.
Okay, and this was year 1921.
Yes.
And what you told me that you were on a temporary mission.
Yes.
That's for 3 years. Yeah. So what made you to stay there so long?
Well, when I left, although I left early, I didn't stay the full 3 years because I was ill and they sent me home early. But at that time, it was evident that the principal, Miss McHenry, was going to be married. And so the mission asked me to prepare to come back and take over the school. So when I came back to America, I studied education instead of doctoring. Yeah.
So how long did you stay in the United States before you went back?
Just 2 years.
2 years.
Yes.
And then you went back to Tehran.
And I went back there. I didn't go to Tehran. I went back to Hamadan.
Oh.
Because everybody felt that if I went to Tehran, I knew so many people there, I would not have time to study the language. So they put me in Hamadan for a year to concentrate on learning Persian. And then I went back to Tehran in 27.
Was Hamadan much different from Tehran at that time?
Yes. Oh, yes, it was very different. Much more primitive in every way. The students were very backward. And the schools and everything were nothing like those in Tehran. And of course in Tehran, the schools for girls were very few. There was a Nahmus school, which was very well known, and they graduated their girls from a seventh class. That was their highest class. And the only other school that had higher grades was a Zoroastrian school. And the Zoroastrian school for some years drew their principals from Iran Bethel. It was always one of our girls that was in charge there, because we had the highest educated girls in the country.
Was your school registered with the government or with Wizarat al-Ma'arif at that time, I guess?
Yes. But to begin with, of course, if there was a Wizarat al-Ma'arif, it had nothing to do with our schools. I mean, it wasn't interested. After all, under Ahmad Shah, everything was just at a standstill. But then after Wizarat Shah took over, things were different, and the Wizarat al-Farhang became active. It was, I think, must have been in 1925, when I was not there, that they had the first inspection from the Minister of Education. And two men came to look over the school, and as they reported, it was the first time that any men had been in the school in all those years, except for Nasruddin Shah's visit. And these gentlemen went around, inspected everything, and approved of it and so forth, and from then on we had inspectors. But to begin with, that is for the first 50 years practically, we were completely free to do anything we wanted to. And for that reason, we didn't develop the Persian language as it should have been developed. To begin with, when I first went there, the Armenians had their Armenian classes and the Persians had their Persian classes. And the Armenians studied Persian as a second language and learned very, very little. If you know any of our graduates back before 25, the Armenian graduates, they knew very little Persian.
I'm going to leave you.
What was the official teaching language of the school?
Really, the official language was English. To begin with, we started teaching English in the fifth grade, primary. And then when the Ministry of Education took over, they said it shouldn't be begun until the seventh class. So we had to change that. But really, the language of the school was English. And the missionaries there didn't know Persian. They knew Armenian rather than Persian, because they worked with the Armenians.
Sit straight. That's better. Oh, sit straight.
Were you giving out any sort of diploma or certificates?
Yes, we gave a diploma all through the years. As I said, the first graduating class was in 1891, and we gave a certificate of having completed the 12 grades.
And who was honoring it?
There wasn't anybody to honor it at that time, because the girls had never applied for any work or anything. They simply, it was their pride and joy that they had graduated. And the plumber that we had in those days had a nice picture of the school, nice little round one on the top of it. And they were very proud of those. To begin with, of course, they didn't have any alumni association because there weren't enough alumni to have such. But I think it was in 1915 that they first started an alumni association. And there were only 6 graduates at that time to be members of it.
When did you make up your mind to stay in Iran for such a long time? Was it a difficult decision to make?
No, I don't think so. I think it just gradually came along. I mean, I'd lived there for so many years, and when it was time for me to retire, I had no family left in this country to come to. All my friends were there, so I retired there.
Okay, Mr. Little, please tell me a little bit about the changes that you have observed in the life of the people during all these years.
Yeah.
You told me about the primitive way of life that they had when you got to Tehran. And when you left Tehran, there have been so much advancement and development in that country, and you are one of the honest witnesses of all this progress in that country. Let's hear from you.
Well, of course, it really came about quite gradually, I think. And it was all thanks to the Pahlavi dynasty. If that hadn't come in and taken over, if Reza Shah hadn't insisted on the freedom of women, of course the Day of the Freedom of Women was really a very exciting time. And that was in 1937, in January. And before that, there'd been a lot of talk about women unveiling. And the girls in our school, of course, were gradually getting rid of their veils. Every day as they came to school, there'd be shouts at another girl appearing without her veil or with a hat on, because of those days they wore hats. And then in January 1937, we had the orders from the Ministry of Education that in order to receive the diplomas of the 11th class, which was all they had then, of the previous year, 1936, that the students and their principals were to appear at the teacher's training college there on Roosevelt Avenue. And all the girls had to be completely in white, and we were told what the principals should wear and so forth. I think it was to begin at 2 o'clock in the afternoon. So we were fortunate in that we had the 12th class, as for all the girls who had received their diplomas the year before were on hand, and so we could get hold of them and get them dressed in their white dresses and stockings and shoes and all the rest of it. And then we went to the teacher training college, and the girls were all lined up in one room, a line side by side with the principal at the head of each line, and the boys were in another room. And we stood there waiting for a while. In the room where the women were, and they one by one called up the school, and the school principal went and received the diplomas from Her Majesty and took them back to the girls. And when that was finally finished, then the girls were all told to go down, line up on both sides of the road out to the main road. It was winter, there was snow, but all the girls had to go there in their white clothes, no coats or anything. We lined up there for their majesties to leave. Then the next morning, we had word from the Ministry of Education to come there for a meeting. And we all got there, and then the minister said, now that their Her Majesty and her daughters appeared without chadors, they had hats, proper clothes, it is unseemly that any woman Iran should appear with anything but a hat. And we were to see to it in our schools that nobody came except in modern European clothing. So that's what happened. We all went back. And for me, it was easy because I said our girls had already started doing that. But as you probably know, no woman was allowed on the street with any scarf of any sort over her head.
By the way, did you have to wear chador?
No.
As a foreigner, you didn't have to?
No.
Weren't you facing any objection from the people?
No. When I went out in the villages, they were surprised and thought we were men because we didn't have chadors on, but I was never compelled to wear a chador. And in fact, I never did. I mean, to get into some places, of course, you had to have a veil to go there. So I never went to those places where they didn't want you. But one time we had a very fine black woman who had been a slave. She worked for me for 27 years. And then she died of cancer. And she was buried out by Zim. And I wanted to go there to the cemetery. And I put on the chador for that, because they wouldn't let me without. But that's the only time I wore chador outside.
You mean, at that time in 1921,
yes,
you could walk in the streets of Tehran,
yes,
with bare head,
yes,
and without wearing a chador,
yes, yes,
and facing no objection from, no, even the fanatics?
No. If there was any objection, we never heard it. They were used to these American women. We got by with it. Of course, the Armenian women wore chadors.
They did?
Yes, they did. But we didn't. We never did.
And do you know that now you cannot do that in Tehran?
Yes, I know. Bertrand Rolla's sister Mary is there in Tehran, and she has such a time having to have, in the summertime, long sleeves. She can't go out with short sleeves. And she has to have a scarf on her head.
Interview with Ms. Doolittle will continue on the other side of the tape, on side B.